This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll be talking about evidence of a 10,000-year-old massacre and the origins of violence in humans. But first, you foodies know that eating is an all-in sensory experience. There's the smell of a steaming bowl of soup, the sight of a chocolatey ice cream sundae, and that crispy crunch of a perfectly cooked vegetable. All the sensory delights together create the taste of a dish. But when was the last time you listened? You listened to the food close up. My next guest says that a little sonic sprinkling can enhance or deflate flavors, and we're not just talking about that sizzling steak. Dan Pashman is no stranger to composing a harmonious meal. He's the host of WNYC's The Sporkful Podcast. He joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
I got a bag of potato chips. They are the noisiest thing. They got the first thing. You open the bag, then you have the crunk. I can't talk, so you better take over.
All right, I'll take it from here. Yeah, the noise of that package is no accident. In fact, long before we had some of the research we have now, we now know that the people who designed potato chip bags, they didn't make them noisy for the sake of the chips. They made them noisy for the sensory experience because they understood that a noisy food was better complemented with a noisy package.
Is that right?
Yes. And in fact, research has shown that if people hear that the sound of that packaging mm-hmm. being crumpled while they're eating the chips, they will think that the chips are crisper, crunchier, fresher, better, only because that sound is being played in the background.
Wow. So if you took that sound away, they wouldn't think the chip is as good.
Correct. And the effect is even magnified with the chips themselves. So this researcher, Charles Spence, who's one of my guests on the Sporkful podcast this week, he did this study with Pringles, which
right.
we'll say their brand name because it's integral to the science here, because they're uniform.
Right.
So you can control for chip variation.
Mm.
And he had people bite into a chip in front of a microphone and then alter the sound that they would hear in their ears. And what he found is that when he amplified the sound of the crunch, even if in reality it was the same,
yeah.
when he amplified the sound, people thought the chips were better.
Wow. And you're always looking for the best way to eat and about composing the tastiest spice. Do you have an ideal soundscape for your meals? What should the soundscape when you eat?
Well, I think that like with so many things in food, it's relative. I think there are different soundscapes for different meals. There's a famous chef in London, Heston Blumenthal, who has taken a cue from Charles Spence's research. And when you order his seafood dishes at his restaurant in London, he brings you an iPod. And you put the headphones on and you listen to sounds of the ocean and the waves crashing and the seagulls as you eat your shellfish. And the research shows that that does help to enhance the experience.
So do you foresee that restaurants might be pairing this now in this age, food with sound?
I think it makes a lot of sense. And I hope that they'll also, in the opposite direction, sometimes they're pairing the wrong kind of sound with food. So we see more and more restaurants now, they put a lot of focus into the music they're going to play. That's part of the identity or the ambiance, but often the music is very loud. And research shows that when you're surrounded by a very high decibel level, your taste perception goes down. So loud music means the food will have less flavor. It also works the same on an airplane, where you have a high decibel level, and that's one of the reasons why you get less taste perception on an airplane.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a chocolate bar sitting in front of me.
Oh, this is going to be fun.
We're going to conduct a taste test, right?
This is an experiment live on the air on Science Friday.
All right, what should I do here?
And I should say to listeners at home, you can do this at home right now with coffee. If you don't have dark chocolate handy, grab your mug of coffee. Here's what I want you to do, Ira.
Yeah.
I want you to take a bite of that chocolate and really hold it in your mouth and savor it. Our listeners at home, you're doing your coffee.
Okay.
And I want you to really note how sweet or bitter it tastes. Concentrate on how sweet or bitter the flavor is and really kind of give it a rating in your head.
Mm-hmm.
How sweet or bitter is it?
Okay, I'm doing that now. Let me tell you what rating is.
No, just mm-hmm. get it in your head.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, so keep that chocolate in your mouth. Continue to think about how sweet or bitter it is. And now we're going to play some background music.
Hmm.
What do you think?
You know, it was distracting a little bit
okay.
from the taste, but it didn't taste as sweet.
Okay. Possibly more bitter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you still have a good amount of chocolate
mm-hmm.
in your mouth? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, listeners at home, if you're out of chocolate or if you need more coffee, take another sip, fill your mouth, think again about how sweet or bitter it tastes, and
mm-hmm.
now listen to this.
more pleasant. It's a more pleasant experience. Tastes a little sweeter.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Why? What's going on here?
Well, as Charles Spence explains it, basically, when you have a food like a dark chocolate or a coffee that has a lot of varying and complementary or even contrasting notes like sweetness and bitterness, it can be hard for your brain to make sense of it all and to latch on to something. And these different pitches of sound and of music sort of act as ways to highlight certain features of a food. It's kind of like, you know, if you're drinking a glass of wine and some wine expert says, oh, don't you taste the notes of asparagus? Well, you know, now, of course, you taste it as soon as he says that.
Right.
It's a similar kind of function. And he actually explains that it all goes to this idea that we'll play a clip from him on the Sporkful podcast of the way the mind and taste work together.
The whole idea of taste and flavor is a construction of our mind. It is all kind of an illusion that we think we taste food in our mouth when, in fact, most of the interesting stuff is happening in our nose. So flavors and tastes and flavors are full stop, kind of, you know, an illusion. And if I think about things like there are certain smells that you will describe as sweet. Things like caramel and vanilla and maybe strawberry. Smells do not actually have a taste, but I can use those sweet smells to almost trick your brain into tasting sweetness that isn't there.
He can do that. And we've heard that, and he's backing up the idea that smell is a very important part of tasting.
Absolutely. And I'm just generally fascinated with this idea that so much of what we perceive to be happening in our mouths is actually happening in our brains.
Mm. And sound can come in handy when you're cooking, too. If you listen to your food, you can tell if you've made a mistake, I understand.
Yeah. Has this ever happened
food
to you, Ira?
Yes.
You ever throw a piece of meat into the pan and you don't hear any sound and you kind of feel like you hear a wah, wah. It's not the sound you wanted to hear because you didn't hear a sizzle.
Right.
You know, that's...
You have to turn on the heat.
You have to turn it on and turn it on high so you get that sizzle going. But also in this episode of the Sporkful podcast, I talked to Kenji Lopez-Alt, who's the food science guru from Sirius Eats. And he took me into the test kitchen there. And he told me this great story. His first job in a fancy restaurant, he was like the bottom of the barrel prep chef. And he had to cut chives for 45 minutes straight for every station in the restaurant. And after 45 minutes of slicing chives... The chef, the head chef of the restaurant, walks by and stops and says, "You're cutting those wrong." She wasn't looking. She didn't look. She could tell that he was cutting them wrong just by the sound he was making when he was cutting. So first, let's play the sound of the wrong way to cut scallions, then we'll describe what's happening. Sounds like a chopping.
Yeah, like an axe almost.
That's right. What's happening there is that it is a chop. It's straight down, and you are essentially crushing plant cells. And that creates a chemical reaction that releases lacrimators, which are the things in an onion that make you cry.
But don't you want that reaction, that taste, the full taste, to mix those together?
I think most people prefer a little bit of that pungency of the onion, but also with its natural sweetness.
So you don't get that if you crush it.
Right. If you crush it, you get too much of that pungency. So what you want to do instead, rather than chopping straight down and crushing, you want to slice very smoothly and gently in a horizontal way so that you crush as few plant cells as possible. So the sound should be almost imperceptible, but listen very closely.
Yeah. You know, there's almost a mindfulness about it, you know, where you are focused on that and you're going to make the cut just right. And you're enjoying the whole experience by being mindful of what you're doing at that moment.
Totally. And that's something that I think definitely enhances the eating experience. And because sound is sort of the forgotten sense in eating and cooking, if you force yourself to focus on that thing you don't normally focus on, I think you'll get more pleasure out of the eating experience and also be more focused and sort of... I find cooking to be a great way to relax, a sort of decompression. And when you're really focused on just the sound the scallions are making, I find it very peaceful.
Yeah, there's a lot of sound. You know, if you do think about it, and I'm thinking about it as we're speaking, there are a lot of sounds that go on when you're preparing food. Even this, the sound of a wooden spoon on the pan is very soothing, I think, in an idea. It's like homey. Comfort food.
Very much. Sometimes I get frustrated when my wife uses a metal spoon to stir things in a metal pot. I think now that you say that, I realize that part of it is it's like a nails on the chalkboard sound to me. Whereas the wooden spoon is a homey sound. The metal sound sounds abrasive.
Well, I'm going to guess that you're not crazy about people sitting down, eat dinner, and then they're on their phone all the time, right?
No, absolutely. I did a piece a while back about eating alone. I did for Valentine's Day. And I interviewed Deepak Chopra about sort of mindfulness. And he talked about focusing on what you're eating and putting away the distractions and really using all of your senses. And right after I spoke to him, I went out and got a slice of pizza. And it was one of the best slices of pizza. I didn't look at my phone. I really took time to feel the pizza in my mouth, to feel it going down into my stomach, and to look closely at it. I can still picture in my head the little droplets of oil on the surface of the cheese and these little tributaries of sauce flowing down the slice of pizza.
Yeah.
And
it just paid attention.
Oh, yeah. That was good. I call that total pizza awareness.
Well, I'm sure marketers and companies are really interested in this kind of stuff, right? I mean, how can sound be used beyond just selling us more stuff?
Right. Although, interestingly, that's one of the slightly controversial points of Charles Spence's research, is that a lot of his research is to help corporations sell their things more effectively. And there are some in his field who have criticized him for not delving more deeply into understanding the why on a neurological level and just sort of coming up with these clever takeaways.
Have any exercises that we could do to be more aware of sound while we're preparing food? Just be quiet and turn the TV off, turn the cell phone off, and listen to the sound.
Well, I'll give you one more quick one. If you have a chocolate bar handy from our previous experiment, you can also learn a lot about a chocolate bar by the sound it makes when you break it in half. That's a pretty good sound.
Yeah.
You want a thud. You want a deep, strong noise with a bit of bass to it. You don't want a thin sound, and that is an indication of how well tempered the chocolate is. Because when you make chocolate, there are different crystal forms that it can take, and the more desirable ones will make a lower sound.
All right, Dan, those are great ideas about cooking. And if you're still hungry, you can subscribe to Dan Pashman's The Sporkful podcast on iTunes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ira.
And we also have our taste test. You could try it yourself. It's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/foodsound. We're going to take a break. When we come back, a look at the origins of human violence with a big massacre that took place 10,000 years ago. We'll have the details after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The question of the origin of violence in humans it's really a thorny question. Have we always been warlike? Did we inherit our violent natures from our primate ancestors? Or is it something that we've developed later in our history? Well, in findings published in the journal Nature, archaeologists report the discovery of the oldest evidence of mass violence to date, the skeletal remains of a massacre that occurred 10,000 years ago on the shores of Lake Turkana in present-day Kenya. Ronica Power is a research fellow at the McDonnell Institute for Archaeological Research, a Department of Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. She helped analyze the fossilized skeletons found at the site. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Power.
Thank you so much, Ira. It's a great pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. Tell us about this site. What was found there?
So at this site, the site is called Nataruk, and it's in West Turkana in Kenya. And at the site, we found at least 28 individuals in total, and there's a demographic range, a range of people that were found there. And amongst them, there were 5 young children, 1 teenager, 21 adults, and 1 fetus. And of those 28 individuals, we found 12 skeletons that were found as they died, unburied and with their bodies articulated in anatomical position, but in very unusual positions. And of these 12 articulated skeletons, 10 of these show skeletal evidence of the most violent trauma.
So they all show signs of being killed, some clubbed. What kind of ways did they die?
So the skeletal evidence, the kinds of lesions, the kinds of wounds and injuries that we're seeing on the skeletons suggests that there were at least 3 different types of weapons that may have been used in this attack, Ira. And the different kinds of weapons include things that may have been stone-tipped and sharpened, like arrows, and we call them projectiles. Mm-hmm. And we also think that there may have been clubs that were used in this attack, and also potentially another, what we're calling a close proximity weapon, so something else that would have been held in the hand. But to make it even more terrifying, more frightful, it's possible that this close proximity weapon had sharp stones and blades that were embedded in it, that to give it that extra force, that extra trauma when the victims were hit.
Does this have the earmark of a war or a raid on a tribe that caught them unaware?
Well, it does seem as though they were caught unaware. I mean, very interestingly, what we extrapolate from the different kinds of skeletal trauma is that it appears that they were at first taken unawares by things such as arrows. It appears that the perforation lesions and some of the sharp force trauma lesions were caused by arrows, which, as you know, are more of a medium range kind of weapon. And so it seems as though they may have been ambushed as they were there on the shores of ancient Lake Turkana, and then once they were stopped and were obviously stopped in their tracks by this arrows attack, as the attacking other group came closer to them, that is when they would have used these more close proximity weapons. So it appears that there were different ranges and different kinds of attack that were happening at within this whole kind of war or raiding incident, as you say.
Can you tell us about these people? When did they live there? What was their community like? Why were they encamped there?
Yeah, of course. So these people were what we call hunter-gatherer fishers. They were nomadic people. They moved around, and they were living 10,000 years ago on the shores of ancient Lake Turkana. And at that time, it was very lush and fertile. It's almost hard to imagine it being that way now when you go. It's sand and dust and rocks as far as the eye can see. But 10,000 years ago, it was lush and fertile. And the In Africa project that discovered these skeletons have also discovered thousands of animal fossils from all different types of creatures, things like elephants and giraffes and hippopotamus and rhinoceri and zebra and warthog. The list goes on. And we know from the fossil evidence of these animals is that the humans were around and they were hunting them. We can see evidence for them butchering the animals and processing them. And so we suspect that at Nataruk that these people were probably camped there, these hunter-gatherer fishers, to spend some time there and to gather resources and to eat and to live their lives.
Our number is 844-724-8255 if you'd like to join the conversation. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry. Talking with Dr. Ronica Power from the University of Cambridge in the UK. So the way you describe it, it seems like a very coveted place to be. I mean, all those resources there and a place that maybe other people would like to have raided.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're 100% right. I think what we're talking about here comes down to competition for resources. I think you're absolutely right, Ira.
And is this really the oldest remains of a big battle like that?
Yes, this is the earliest scientifically dated case of conflict between two groups of hunter-gatherers. It's an extraordinary find, and it's exceptional in a number of ways. Not only is it that earliest scientifically dated case, but it's exceptional also in the fact that the number of preserved remains, of human skeletal remains, for this time period is also exceptional. And also the fact that they are in such close proximity to each other. Usually this kind of preservation and that kind of closeness of skeletons being together is only observed in cemeteries. And, you know, we don't have that for these nomadic people. And that's also why this evidence is so exceptional, because to find evidence of warfare amongst nomadic people in the archaeological record is extremely rare.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that they weren't buried? They were just left where they were, thinking that maybe their comrades would bury them after they had died.
Well, that's assuming that that's assuming that there were people left alive.
Oh, that's
so. Yeah, it's a haunting image. I would encourage your readers to access the article through the Nature website and to have a look at some of these diagrams. And it's very evocative to see these people in such unusual positions. And we can tell that they fell and that the sediments of the paleo lagoon has covered them as they lay, and they've stayed there for 10,000 years until our team from the In Africa project happened upon them in 2012.
So sort of like a Pompeii sort of burial, where they get
covered. In terms of a frozen moment in time. And, you know, the nature and the position of the bodies and the nature of the lesions. As scientists, we are certainly trained to be objective and to carry out our work with a certain amount of distance. But as a human, you can't help but look at all of this evidence and be really moved by it and really feel for these people.
Yeah, there's a skeleton of one woman that was particularly striking. She was pregnant.
Isn't she incredible?
A 6 to 9 month old fetus still inside?
Yes, that's exactly right.
And you could see that.
Yeah, absolutely. So she really is an incredible case, Ira. And the fact that she's in that almost seated, upright position, and we see that her arms are placed between her legs, and the very unique position of both her hands and her feet indicate that she could have been bound. Her hands and feet could have been tied together at the time that she died. And you reconstruct that image in your mind, and you see a lady with a large pregnant belly. And we discovered the remains, the bones of a 6 to 9 month old fetus within her abdominal cavity. And what this shows you is that no one was spared. The kind of vulnerability that we see about this particular site is that everyone of every age group was vulnerable at Nataruk. Men, women, even pregnant women, young, old. Unfortunately, it does seem as though no one survived.
A ferocious attack. This was done on purpose, is what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that what this shows you is that under certain conditions, fighting for what others have may be the only way that humans, you know, in certain conditions can survive.
Let me go to the phones if I can. 844-724-8255. We have a call from Augusta, Georgia. Heather, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there. What a fascinating conversation. I had a quick question. In the description about the brutality and the weapon used, it made me actually think about Mesoamerica and pre-Columbian warfare, particularly with the Aztec Empire. And I'm wondering if the description of the club makes me think of embedded obsidian glass into clubs that were used in that area. Is there any similarity to what you're finding? I know across space and time, it made me think of that same type of weaponry and that same type of violence.
What an astute question, Heather. Thank you so much. And we do know from the evidence that we have that obsidian blades were also used in this attack. We have one of the individuals that was found with an obsidian point embedded into their cranium, embedded into the top side of their skull. And it's incredible to find something like that, but to actually find it in situ is incredible. But we also have another obsidian blade that was found amongst the what we call the lithic or the stone tools assemblage. And yes, definitely, we have lithics made of obsidian amongst this. And what's very interesting is that obsidian actually is quite a rare stone in this area, Heather. And that suggests that the attackers came from or had contact with a different and potentially very distant place.
Thank you, Heather. Great question. She's got. You seem surprised by all of this, if I would go out on a limb from your reaction.
I would say I am almost overwhelmed. I mean, I have dealt with thousands and thousands of skeletons in my career so far, and hopefully we'll deal with many more. But to see this kind of violence, this kind of brutality in such a concise, in such a closed community is really quite striking. And I think that I would speak for all of my colleagues on the In Africa project that this has touched us. This has left a really strong imprint on us as scientists and as archaeologists that will stay with us for a long time.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Annika Power of the University of Cambridge in the UK. Does it make you think differently about how violence erupted among humans. So 10,000 years ago is a long time, so to speak, but not such a long time.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. You're right. In terms of geological time, it's almost the blink of an eye. But I think that one of the reasons why this particular assemblage, this particular case is so interesting and so significant is because it does add to that understanding of the history and violence of warfare. Now, many scholars have argued that hunter-gatherers, as these people from Ngunnawal were 10,000 years ago, didn't engage in warfare. This is why this case is so special. People didn't think that hunter-gatherers did this sort of thing because they were not sedentary. They moved around because they did not own land or have significant possessions. And therefore, scholars have thought that they didn't have anything worth stealing or worth defending. And so, therefore, the line of thinking, the logical line of thinking from that position is that warfare only emerged after sedentism, so after people stopped and were stationary and lived in the same place. So the introduction of agriculture, for example, of farming and more complex political systems are generally when we see these kinds of interpersonal, intergroup violence come to the fore. But what Ngunnawal does is Ngunnawal shows us that conflict and violence has a much longer history. What Ngunnawal does is that it redefines the conditions under which humans will fight each other and really makes our understanding of these kinds of human engagements much more broad and much more diverse than previously thought.
Does it change the way you look at archaeological sites now? In terms of looking for more possibly weapons than you would have in the past?
Well, absolutely. I mean, every single case of archaeological engagement always adds to our understanding and always informs the way that you'll work in the future. And I think one of the really important points about Ngunnawal in particular, but the In Africa project in general, is that it really endorses the engagement with the local community. And the fascinating thing about this discovery is that the team and our director, Dr. Marta Mirazon-Lahr, was actually led to the site by a local person. His name, Pedro Abella, and he reported to Dr. Mirazon-Lahr that he had reported seeing some bones on the surface in a distant place than the team was already working. And so if it wasn't for the In Africa's project's engagement with the local community, they actually may never have seen this site, and these individuals that we have now come to know and have studied so closely may actually still be lying there on the shores of the ancient lake.
Does this lead you to look for more places on those shoreline, the old shoreline? And is this site finished, or is there more to be dug up from the site?
That's an excellent question, Ira. So in the first case, the recovery strategy of the In Africa project was to excavate the skeletons that were exposed, and these are seen as being at the greatest risk of further deterioration. But that's certainly not to say that there may be more individuals that are there underneath the sands, underneath the desert surface. And part of the In Africa project going forward, and indeed some of its members, the activities going forward will be to continue to work in this area.
Mm-hmm. And you yourself have are you going to be doing some more digging?
Wherever the In Africa project works, I can tell you I am very, very keen to follow. It is an incredible place, and the Turkana Basin Institute has been an incredible source of support. I went there in 2013 to study all of these amazing, extraordinary skeletons, and it is an incredible place to work out there in the middle of remote Kenya, and it's an extraordinary experience and one that I absolutely hope that I'll have again.
Oh, we have a link to the research paper on our website at sciencefriday.com. It is really interesting, and even 10,000 years later, gruesome looking. I want to thank you, Dr. Power, for taking time to be with us today.
It's a great pleasure, and all the best to you and your listeners.
Ronica Power, Research Fellow at the McDonald Institute for Archaeological Research and the Department of Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. When we come back, does Apple deserve its old reputation for good design. We're going to talk with a designer who says, not anymore. And he should know, he was been there from the beginning. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's a story about Steve Jobs from the early Macintosh days. One weekend, Jobs paid a visit to the Macy's in Palo Alto. He wanted to take a look at the Cuisinarts. This was what the Mac should be like, he thought to himself. A beautiful, friendly, easy-to-use appliance right out of the box. No manuals required. Pretty simple. And back at the office, Jobs demanded that his Mac designers buy a Cuisinart of their own and learn a few things. Well, for years, Apple has had a reputation for intuitive, easy-to-use machines. Machines like that Cuisinart from a long time ago. But lately, Apple products like the Mac and the iPhone have lost their ease to use, their intuitive feel, no longer deserving that reputation for good design, at least according to my next guest. Tog Tagnazzini is a principal designer at the Nielsen Norman Group, and for 14 years he was Apple's human interface evangelist under Steve Jobs. And now in an article for Fast Company, he writes that Apple is destroying design. Tog, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Tell us where Apple has gone wrong. What do you mean? What? Why did you feel you needed to write this?
3 or 4 years ago, we began to see that something was falling out from Apple. Before that, Steve Jobs was the final arbiter of Apple design. And after his death, there was no one who took that position and no group that took that position. That position is usually filled by people that are known as behavioral designers or human-computer interaction designers. And there's a methodology that assures before you send a product out that that product is actually going to work. That process has been stopped at Apple. Jobs used to do that on his own. Now it's simply not being done, and we're having products come out that have some serious usability issues that have not been flagged before they're in the market and then can take as long as a year to correct.
Give me an example or two.
Well, for example, in iOS 7, they moved to ultra-thin fonts for the home screens. These were so thin, and they were about 50% gray, that anyone over about 40 years old that was very likely to either see extremely blurry fonts or not see fonts at all. All they had to do is have one test subject come in who was a 50-year-old man or woman, sit down, tell them, we'd like you to do the following, and they would say, well, I would love to, but there's no writing on the screen. Can you help me out here? And they would have realized there was a problem. Instead of that, they ship a few million phones, and a lot of people discovered that morning that they updated their software that they had become handicapped, and they had to go into the settings on their phone and declare themselves disabled so that Apple would then make the fonts broader, with the paradoxical effect that all the developers' fonts, which were perfectly okay, were now double width and extremely unattractive, making the phone for the next 365 days extremely unattractive.
Yeah, I plead guilty to that. I had to go in and fool around with the controls to make it a little more visible. But and that goes to the point about simplicity, you know? It's things are just not... I remember from the days when when Steve Jobs would say you should be able to just look at it and use it without having a manual.
Correct. And then they went for the illusion of simplicity instead of actual simplicity, where you just desperately want those screens to look so clean that when people are considering buying the phone, that those screens are shouting to them, this is going to be easy to use. But when you start hiding things in the process of making the screens clean, you're actually making the usability more difficult and the user's tasks more difficult.
One of my favorite points you make is the undo button on the iPhone. I'm willing to bet that most people don't know they have an undo on the iPhone.
Well, and that can be good. It works about 30% of the time.
Where is the undo button?
It's in your hand. You hold the phone and you vigorously, violently shake it. So if you ever see an iPhone user who appears to become insane,
they're not making a martini.
Yeah, they're attempting to undo, and you just do it more and more, hoping it will happen. And by the end, if it doesn't undo, you are angry as you look. And about 10% of the time, you shake it so vigorously it flies out of your hand and crashes into the wall. Mm-hmm. So it's just a bad mechanism.
And you know, when we say, and we blame ourselves, right? I should know how this thing works the right way.
Yes. I'm foolish. I should have read the non-existent manual. I should know how to do these things. And the wonderful thing is Apple's developing this great gestural language, but they're not extending it. It's frozen. So there's been a gesture around for 100 years for undo, which is used by proofreaders, which is a line that starts and makes a loop in the middle and then continues on. And that could be taught to people. And from then on, they wouldn't have to violently shake their phone. They would just simply do that on the screen and it would undo.
Mm-hmm. Now you worked with, as you say, with Steve Jobs for many years. Is it You tried to make this point. I'm going to ask it again. But is it because he is gone that the problems got worse or getting insane, or remain bad?
Yes, but he did not put in place the people that would be able to carry on this particular function when he left. So this is a management problem at Apple. Apple needs to have a vigorous human-computer interaction group with the power to test products to ensure that this year's works at least as well as last year's before they're released and so forth. This is the function he performed on the side in addition to running this multi-billion mm-hmm. dollar company. And it was just simply left out. It needs to be in place.
What about the problem that the canvas that we're working on is so much smaller now? You were designing for desktops, and today's Apple designers are trying to make everything fit on a watch.
A watch is difficult, but Apple has had enough sense to realize that the watch and the phone work together so that you do have this giant screen of the telephone when you need it. I think what they've done is a first draft on the watch is quite good. And then by the time you get to the phone, the smallest iPhone has more pixels on the screen than the original Mac. So the limitations that are being placed on the phones are being done artificially by Apple. They're not inherent.
Mm-hmm. What about their trend toward flat design? They did away with the old icons on the iPhone that were colorful and looked 3D and went to a flat design.
Yeah, it's ironic that after so many years, we finally have the pixel density and the color density to actually make icons that would be recognizable. Excuse me. And they've made an effort to ensure that that doesn't happen in the furtherance of flat design. Mm-hmm. The only thing good about flat design is that it too shall pass.
Really? How are you so sure about that?
Because fashion is all about the new, and you have to make the old look old by coming up with the new fashion.
So you're hopeful. Take a drink of water if you want to. Go ahead.
Thank you.
So you're hopeful then that things might change over there.
Yeah, I am. Someone at Apple has to get the message that they need usability people. And then things will instantly change for the better. Mm-hmm. You can still do flat design and have it be productive and useful and learnable and everything else. The problem is that if you don't test it and you just throw out new ideas, you don't know what's going to happen. So,
and one last thing about the design. What about all the submenus you don't know are there? Where it used to be, you know? You have to go hunt for them. It used to be that it would be self-explanatory.
Yeah, and that's not inherent in flat design. That's inherent in bad design and in the illusion of simplicity, where it's more important that people who haven't bought yet think it's simple than for users to be able to use it. And that's another thing that usability would come back and say, this is not working. We've given the person the task to do this, and they can't do it without using Apple's help system, which is called Google, to find out how to do it.
We've run out of time, but Todd, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It was a great pleasure.
Todd Nazzini is a principal designer at the Nielsen Norman Group. He was founder of Apple's Human Interface Group. And we invite folks from Apple. Anybody from Apple wants to come on and rebut, Johnny Ive, come on and tell us about what you're doing. We'll be right back after this little button. If you ride mass transit, do you think twice about reaching for that pole or the handle? We all know that they are covered in germs. A toddler with his thumb in his mouth, he grabs a subway pole, and there's a sticky streak of saliva left. A woman sneezes and blankets the entire train in itty-bitty microbes. Well, we who ride in the subway know it's not for germaphobes, or you won't be there. But how many riders do you know go out in search of subway bacteria? Craig Ward does, and he's been taking advantage of the subway bacterial brew to make art. Emily Driscoll brings us that story in our latest sci-fi video. Welcome back, Emily.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Somebody who's gone on the subway, and I've seen the video. It's wonderful. And Craig decided to go out and swab the subways.
Exactly. The inspiration for the project came when he looked at a photograph taken by researcher Tasha Sturm, and she put her son's handprint in a petri dish and grew the bacteria and took a photo of it. So it was bacteria in the shape of her son's handprint. Plus, he was interested in this myth that he heard that holding the handrails on the subway is like shaking hands with 100 people at the same time. Plus, his interest in typography and subway type, all of these three factors together inspired the project.
Wow. What do the artworks look like? They're very colorful.
Oh, yes.
Beautiful. You don't think that bacteria could do this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. In the petri dishes, he takes a sponge that is in the shape of the subway letter or number. So the L train, for example, he'll take an L-shaped sponge. The bacteria will grow in an L shape. But they're very beautiful. He describes them as little worlds. They look like sea life or even stars or little flowers. Very beautiful until you look a little closer and see what you're actually looking at.
Talking with Emily Driscoll about her Science Friday video on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Now, I know that you went out, because I see it in the film, you went out watching him swab subway poles.
I did.
What did the people in the subways think was going on, and how did they react?
Oh, yeah, it was a blast. He was swabbing the seats and the handrails, and if there was a greasy spot on the window in the car, and everybody was giving him a side eye. So it was pretty awkward, and he describes that awkward experience in the video, too.
I mean, You can get away with most things on the New York subway, but I feel like as soon as you start getting out scientific equipment, people, want to raise their eyebrows and maybe, shuffle down the seat a little bit, which is crazy considering the stuff you do deal with on the subway. And I would just try and get it done as quickly as possible. It was a little uncomfortable.
But New Yorkers, they just let everything wash right over them, right?
Yeah.
Has he been able to identify any
of
the bacteria?
Yes. He works with scientists, so he didn't do any scientific testing himself, but he did a visual identification, and he found a lot of benign bacteria, but he did find E. coli, Salmonella, Staph, Strep, and sepsis. And at the same time, Dr. Chris Mason at Weill Cornell Medical College, he did a massive study, he and his team, called the PathoMap Projects, and they looked at more than 400 stations around New York City, and they extracted DNA from more than 15,000 types of life forms, only half of which have ever been identified by. So we don't know what half of those 15,000 are.
Wow.
And he found the same sort of thing. Their results were pretty much in line with the E. coli, Salmonella, strep, and Salmonella.
Did he find any strange ones that no one expected it to be there?
Yeah, he found a lot associated with food, actually. Bacteria associated with mozzarella and kimchi, sauerkraut, and even the South Ferry Station. It was flooded by Hurricane Sandy. So that kind of looked like a marine underwater environment based on the bacteria. And they found species that are often found in, and they thrive in Antarctic waters.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, we know that New York is a diverse place, but they didn't realize the biome, the microbiome in New York subways was such a diverse place. Are we the only city where the subway bacteria has
no,
been at all?
Not for long. Chris Mason is building on this project. So he's doing a global version of PathoMap, which is called MetaSub. And so he's looking to build molecular profiles of other cities like Shanghai, Moscow, Paris, right. Sao Paulo, 45 cities so far.
Should we be fearful that the same bacteria he has is the same stuff we're going to get if we go in the subways, or what happens to the bacteria?
Well, most of the bacteria, it doesn't last very long because of the metal on the subway and because they do clean the subways, actually. So the bacteria, they would only survive for a couple of hours. So these portraits that he's taking really are a snapshot of the commuters on a particular day and time and subway line.
What does he do with the Petri dishes? I mean, you don't want to keep growing staph and strep and salmonella in your home,
right,
or wherever you're.
Yeah, he photographs them. And then, like for us, we got to see that. And we made sure to have a lot of Purell handy that day. but then he photographs them and discards them in a proper way. He consults with scientists on that.
Did you have a yuck factor when you were filming this?
It was more intriguing, but they're so beautiful too. Yeah. So it was really fascinating.
They are really beautiful, and the film is very beautiful. Emily, thank you for producing. Emily Driscoll is a science documentary producer based here in New York, and you can watch her video Subvisual Subway at sciencefriday.com. It really is cute. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And if you're feeling a little lethargic, a little groggy now that winter has set in, it might be more than post-holiday blues. It could be SAD. You know what that is. Seasonal Affective Disorder. And you can learn about it at our website at sciencefriday.com/SAD. And while you're there and you're noodling around on the website, check out some beautiful math art illustrations created with a computer. So you have Emily Driscoll's video up there. Now we have math art creations at sciencefriday.com/math-is-beautiful. Have a great weekend. We're here all week. You can tweet us at SciFry. We're on Facebook and our website at sciencefriday.com. Don't be a stranger. Have a great weekend. Hope the snow doesn't do you in. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.